Homo Deus, a brief history of tomorrow. Who are I? Science undermines not only the liberal belief in free will, but also the belief in individualism. Liberals believe that we have a single and indivisible self. To be an individual means that I am individual. Yes, my body is made up of approximately 37 trillion cells, and each day, both my body and my mind go through countless permutations and transformations. Yet, if I really pay attention and strive to get in touch with myself, I am bound to discover deep inside a single clear and authentic voice, which is my true self, and which is the source of all meaning and authority in the universe. For liberalism to make sense, I must have one and only one true self, for if I had more than one authentic voice, how would I know which voice to heed in the polling station, in the supermarket, and in the marriage market? However, over the last few decades, the life sciences have reached the conclusion that this liberal story is pure mythology. The single authentic self is as real as the eternal Christian soul, Santa Claus, and the Easter Bunny. If you look really deep within yourself, the seeming unity that we take for granted dissolves into a cacophony of conflicting voices, none of which is my true self. Humans are not individuals, they are individuals. The human brain is composed of two hemispheres, connected to each other through a thick neural cable. Each hemisphere controls the opposite side of the body. The right hemisphere controls the left side of the body, receives data from the left-hand field of vision, and is responsible for moving the left arm and leg and vice versa. This is why people who have had a stroke in their right hemisphere sometimes ignore the left side of their body, combing only the right side of their hair or eating only the food placed on the right side of their plate. There are also emotional and cognitive differences between the two hemispheres, though the division is far from clear-cut. Most cognitive activities involve both hemispheres, but not to the same degree. For example, in most cases, the left hemisphere plays a more important role in speech and in logical reasoning, whereas the right hemisphere is more dominant in processing spatial information. Many breakthroughs in understanding the relations between the two hemispheres were based on the study of epilepsy patients. In severe cases of epilepsy, electrical storms begin in one part of the brain but quickly spread to other parts, causing a very acute seizure. During such seizures, patients lose control of their body, and frequent seizures consequently prevent patients from holding a job or leading a normal lifestyle. In the mid-20th century, when all of the treatments failed, doctors alleviated the problem by cutting the thick neural cable connecting the two hemispheres, so that electrical storms beginning in one hemisphere could not spill over to the other. For brain scientists, these patients were a goldmine of astounding data. Some of the most notable studies on these split-brain patients were conducted by Professor Roger Walcott-Sperry, who won the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine for his groundbreaking discoveries, and by his student, Professor Michael Gazzaniga. One study was conducted on a teenage boy. The boy was asked what he would like to do when he grew up. The boy answered that he wanted to be a draughtsman. This answer was provided by the left hemisphere, which plays a crucial part in logical reasoning as well as in speech. Yet the boy had another active speech center in his right hemisphere, which could not control vocal language but could spell words like using scrambled tiles. The researchers were keen to know what the right hemisphere would say, so they spread scrambled tiles on the table and then took a piece of paper and wrote on it, "What would you like to do when you grow up?" They placed the paper at the edge of the boy's left visual field. Data from the left visual field is processed in the right hemisphere. Since the right hemisphere could not use vocal language, the boy said nothing. But his left hand began moving rapidly across the table, collecting tiles from here and there. It spelled out automobile race. Spooky. Equally eerie behavior was displayed by patient W.J., a Second World War veteran. W.J.'s hands were each controlled by a different hemisphere. Since the two hemispheres were out of touch with one another, it sometimes happened that his right hand would reach out to open a door, and then his left hand would intervene and try to slam the door shut. In another experiment, Gazzaniga and his team flashed a picture of a chicken claw to the left half brain, the side responsible for speech, and simultaneously flashed a picture of a snowy landscape to the right brain. When asked what they saw, patients invariably answered a chicken claw. Gazzaniga then presented one patient, P.S., with a series of picture cards and asked them to point to the one the best matched what he had seen. The patient's right hand, controlled by his left brain, pointed to a picture of a chicken, but simultaneously his left hand shot out and pointed to a snow shovel. Gazzaniga then asked P.S. the million-dollar question, "Why did you point both to the chicken and to the shovel?" P.S. replied, "Oh, the chicken claw goes with the chicken, and you need a shovel to clean out the chicken shed." What happened here? The left brain, which controls speech, had no data about the snow scene, and therefore did not really know why the left hand pointed to the shovel. So he just invented something credible. After repeating this experiment many times, Gazzaniga concluded that the left hemisphere of the brain is the seat not only of our verbal abilities, but also of an internal interpreter that constantly tries to make sense of our life, using partial clues in order to concoct plausible stories. In another experiment, the nonverbal right hemisphere was shown a pornographic image. The patient reacted by blushing and giggling. "What did you see?" asked the mischievous researchers. "Nothing, just a flash of light," said the left hemisphere, and the patient immediately giggled again, covering her mouth with her hand. "Why are you laughing, then?" they insisted. The bewildered left hemisphere interpreter, struggling for some rational explanation, replied that one of the machines in the room looked very funny. It's as if the CIA conducts a drone strike in Pakistan, unbeknown to the US State Department. When a journalist grills State Department officials about it, they make up some plausible explanation. In reality, the spin doctors do not have a clue why the strike was ordered, so they just invent something. A similar mechanism is employed by all human beings, not just by split-brain patients. Again and again, my own private CIA does things without the approval or knowledge of my State Department, and then my State Department cooks up a story that presents me in the best possible light. Often enough, the State Department itself becomes convinced of the pure fantasies it has invented. Similar conclusions have been reached by behavioral economists who want to know how people take economic decisions, or more accurately, who takes these decisions. Who decides to buy a Toyota rather than a Mercedes, to go on holiday to Paris rather than Thailand, and to invest in South Korean treasury bonds rather than in the Shanghai Stock Exchange? Most experiments have indicated that there is no single self making any of these decisions. Rather, they result from a tug of war between different and often conflicted inner entities. One groundbreaking experiment was conducted by Daniel Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics. Kahneman asked a group of volunteers to join a three-part experiment. In the short part of the experiment, the volunteers inserted one hand into a container filled with water at 14 degrees Celsius for 1 minute, which is unpleasant, bordering on painful. After 60 seconds, they were told to take their hand out. In the long part of the experiment, volunteers placed their other hand in another water container. The temperature there was also 14 degrees Celsius, but after 60 seconds, hot water was secretly added into the container, bringing the temperature up to 15 degrees Celsius. 30 seconds later, they were told to pull out their hand. Some volunteers did the short part first, while others began with the long part. In either case, exactly 7 minutes after both parts were over, came the third and most important part of the experiment. The volunteers were told they must repeat one of the two parts, and it was up to them to choose which. 80% preferred to repeat the long experiment, remembering it as less painful. The cold water experiment is so simple, yet its implications shake the core of the liberal worldview. It exposes the existence of at least two different selves within us, the experiencing self and the narrating self. The experiencing self is our moment-to-moment consciousness. For the experiencing self, it's obvious that the long part of the cold water experiment was worse, First, you experience water at 14 degrees Celsius for 60 seconds, which is every bit as bad as what you experience in the short part. And then, you must endure another 30 seconds of water at 15 degrees Celsius, which is not quite as bad, but still far from pleasant. For the experiencing self, it is impossible that adding a slightly unpleasant experience to a very unpleasant experience will make the entire episode more appealing. However, the experiencing self remembers nothing, it tells no stories, and is seldom consulted when it comes to big decisions. Retrieving memories, telling stories, and making big decisions are all the monopoly of a very different entity within us, the narrating self. The narrating self is akin to Gazaninga's left brain interpreter. It is forever busy spinning yarns about the past and making plans for the future. Like every journalist, poet, and politician, the narrating self takes many shortcuts. It does not narrate everything and usually weaves the story only from peak moments and end results. The value of the whole experience is determined by averaging peaks with ends. For example, in the short part of the cold water experiment, the narrating self finds the average between the worst part, the water was very cold, and the last moment, the water was still very cold, and concludes that the water was very cold. The narrating self does the same thing with the long part of the experiment. It finds the average between the worst part, the water was very cold, and the last moment, the water was not so cold, and concludes that the water was somewhat warmer. Crucially, the narrating self is duration blind, giving no importance to the different lengths of the two parts. So when it has a choice between the two, it prefers to repeat the long part, the one in which the water was somewhat warmer. Every time the narrating self evaluates our experiences, it discounts their duration and adopts the peak-end rule. It remembers only the peak moment and the end moment, and evaluates the whole experience according to their average. This has far-reaching impact on all of our practical decisions. Kahneman began investigating the experiencing self and the narrating self in the early 90s, when, together with Donald Riddlemeyer of the University of Toronto, he studied colonoscopy patients. In colonoscopy tests, a tiny camera is inserted into the guts through the anus in order to diagnose various bowel diseases. It is not a pleasant experience. Doctors want to know how to perform the test in the least painful way. Should they speed up the colonoscopy and cause patients more severe pain for a shorter duration? Or should they work more slowly and carefully? To answer this query, Kahneman and Riddlemeyer asked 154 patients to report the pain during the colonoscopy at 1-minute intervals. They used a scale of 0 to 10, where 0 meant no pain at all, and 10 meant intolerable pain. After the colonoscopy was over, patients were asked to rank the test's overall pain level, also on a scale of 0 to 10. We might have expected the overall rank to reflect the accumulation of minute-by-minute reports. The longer the colonoscopy lasted, and the more pain the patient experienced, the higher the overall pain level. But the actual results were different. Just as in the cold water experiment, the overall pain level neglected duration and instead reflected only the peak end rule. One colonoscopy lasted 8 minutes. At the worst moment, the patient reported level 8 pain, and in the last minute, he reported a level 7 pain. After the test was over, this patient ranked his overall pain level at 7.5. Another colonoscopy lasted 24 minutes. This time too, peak pain was level 8, but in the very last minute of the test, the patient reported a level 1 pain. This patient ranked his overall pain level only at 4.5. The fact that his colonoscopy lasted 3 times as long, and that he consequently suffered far more pain on aggregate, did not affect his memory at all. The narrating self does not aggregate experiences, it averages them. So what do the patients prefer, to have a short and sharp colonoscopy or a long and careful one? There is not a single answer to this question because the patient has at least 2 different selves and they have different interests. If you ask the experiencing self, it will probably prefer a short colonoscopy. But if you ask the narrating self, it will vote for a long colonoscopy because it remembers only the average between the worst moment and the last moment. Indeed, from the viewpoint of the narrating self, the doctor should add a few completely superfluous minutes of dull aches at the very end of the test because it will make the entire memory far less traumatic. Pediatricians know this trick well, so do vets. Many keep in their clinics jars full of treats and hand a few to the kids or dogs after giving them a painful injection or an unpleasant medical examination. When the narrating self remembers the visit to the doctor, 10 seconds of pleasure at the end of the visit will erase many minutes of anxiety and pain. Evolution discovered this trick eons before the pediatricians. Given the unbearable torments women undergo at childbirth, you might think that after going through it once, no sane woman would ever agree to do it again. However, at the end of labor and in the following days, the hormonal system secretes cortisol and beta endorphins, which reduce the pain and create a feeling of relief and sometimes even of elation. Moreover, the growing love towards the baby and the acclaim from friends, family members, religious dogmas, and nationalist propaganda conspire to turn childbirth from a terrible trauma into a positive memory. One study conducted at the Rabin Medical Center in Tel Aviv showed that the memory of labor reflected mainly the peak and end points, while the overall duration had almost no impact at all. In another research project, 2,400 Swedish women were asked to recount their memories of labor 2 months after giving birth. 90% reported that the experience was either positive or very positive. They did not necessarily forget the pain. 28% described it as the worst pain imaginable, yet it did not prevent them from evaluating the experience as positive. The narrating self goes over our experiences with a sharp pair of scissors and a thick black marker. It senses at least some moments of horror and files in the archive a story with a happy ending. Most of our critical life choices of partners, careers, residences, and holidays are taken by our narrating self. Suppose you can choose between two potential holidays. You can go to Jamestown, Virginia, or visit the historic colonial town where the first English settlement on mainland North America was founded in 1607. Alternatively, you can realize your number one dream vacation, whether it is trekking in Alaska, sunbathing in Florida, or having an unbridled bacchanalia of sex, drugs, and gambling in Las Vegas. But there is a caveat. If you choose your dream vacation, then just before you board the plane home, you must take a pill which will wipe out all of your memories of that vacation. What happened in Vegas will forever remain in Vegas. Which holiday would you choose? Most people would opt for colonial Jamestown because most people give their credit card to the narrating self, which cares only about stories and has zero interest in even the most mind-blowing experiences if it cannot remember them. Truth be told, the experiencing self and the narrating self are not completely separate entities, but are closely intertwined. The narrating self uses our experiences as important, but not exclusive, raw materials for its stories. These stories, in turn, shape what the experiencing self actually feels. We experience hunger differently when we fast on Ramadan, when we fast in preparation for medical examination, and when we don't eat because we have no money. The different meanings ascribed to our hunger by the narrating self create very different actual experiences. Furthermore, the experiencing self is often strong enough to sabotage the best laid plans of the narrating self. For example, I can make a New Year resolution to start a diet and go to the gym every day. Such grand decisions are the monopoly of the narrating self, but the following week, when it's gym time, the experiencing self takes over. I don't feel like going to the gym, and instead I order pizza, sit on the sofa, and turn on the TV. Nevertheless, most people identify with their narrating self. When they say I, they mean the story in their head, not the stream of experiences they undergo. We identify with the inner system that takes the crazy chaos of life and spins out of it seemingly logical and consistent yarns. It does not matter that the plot is full of lies and lacunas, and that it is rewritten again and again, so that today's story flatly contradicts yesterday's. The important thing is that we always retain the feeling that we have a single, unchanging identity from birth to death, and perhaps even beyond the grave. This gives rise to the questionable liberal belief that I am an individual, and that I possess a consistent and clear inner voice, which provides meaning for the entire universe.
That's it for today. I create a lot of content, I run a debating podcast, I write stories, I film videos with a drone, and I run many other projects too. If you'd like to stay informed of things I do, sign up to my private newsletter. It's free. Head to bit.ly/newslettersebastian, all attached and in lowercase. Thank you for listening.